Hi, this is Rabbi Eric Levy, and I am pleased to bring to you the Parshav Vayechi, the first Aliyah. The tribe of Israel has been firmly ensconced in the land of Egypt, in the territory of Goshen. Things are apparently peaceful, they are prosperous, and the time of the forefathers is about to come to an end. Therefore, Jacob, coming to the end of his life, wants to command his children and to guide their future. There is an aspect of fear with Jacob. We saw that on the way down to Egypt where God had to tell him not to be afraid. But Jacob, I think, knows very well what is in store for the Jewish people in the next period of time before they manage to be redeemed back to the land of Israel or Canaan. Vayechi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim shiva esrei shana vayechi yimei Yaakov shnei chayav sheva shanim ve'arba'im u'me'at shana. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, and the whole length of his life was 147 years. There's a little bit of redundancy and extra wordiness there in the description of his years, but I'll stick to the plain sense of the translation, which is simply that he was 147 years old. Vayikruvu yimei Yisrael lamud, vayikra livno liyosef, vayomer lo, imna matzati chayin be'inecha, simna yadecha tachat yirechi, ve'asita yimadi, chesed ve'emet, al na tikbereini b'mitzrayim. And as the life of Jacob was nearing death, he called for his son Joseph and said to him, if I have found favor in your eyes, place your hand under my loins and do for me a true act of kindness. Don't bury me in Egypt. Clearly he calls for Joseph, since Joseph is the only one in position to grant grant Jacob's wish. From this and from the upcoming burial story, it should be obvious that there are limits on emigration and immigration already in place at this time in Egypt. And we know, actually, from letters of the Tel El Amarna period, which is about 100 years later than what's going on here, about 1400, that immigration and emigration into and out of Egypt is strictly controlled by the crown. And since Egypt had really controlled more or less all land of Canaan, as well as far north as Lebanon and some of Syria, really who could come and go was at the king's whim. And therefore it was only Joseph who had the power to do this. The phrase, imna matzati chayin be'inecha, if I find pleasure in your eyes, there's a sense that, or favor in your eyes, there's a sense that, it's not going to come easy, that there is a reason to be concerned that the person is not happy, and therefore it's a real supplication of one who is afraid that his wish will not be granted. I think now is the time probably to mention the unusual physical form of this oath, which is that one swears by placing his hand on the privates of one demanding the oath. Avram used this procedure when he made his servant, who was probably Eliezer, even though the name is not stated, when he made him promise not to take Yitzchak, a wife from the local Canaanites, but to go back to Aram, to Avram's family, to take a wife for Yitzchak. Now, I've always felt that over there, the fact that Eliezer had to hold the Yerech, had to hold the private part, reminded Eliezer of the covenant of the Brit Milah, which was a new idea for Avraham. And therefore he's saying that, you know, the blessing in chapter 22 of Bereshit was, I will bless you and I will multiply your seed like the heavens, like the stars of the heavens and like the sands of the, of the shore of the ocean. And so what Abraham is essentially saying to his servant by having him hold the circumcision is that in order to fill this covenant, remember that was in chapter 24, and the promise of the Akedat Yitzchak was in chapter 22, that essentially he's forcing Eliezer to recognize that this is the covenant that God's made with me. And by taking Canaanite women, we're just not going to make that covenant come true. The only way to make the covenant work out is to do what God wants and to go back to the people who are not Canaanites because the Canaanites are too corrupt. Now, that issue doesn't really apply here because Jacob is not concerned about who he's going to marry, whose children's going to marry. He's concerned about his personal burial in Israel. Ibn Ezra, in fact, says, don't look for any parallels between the two stories. He says this was just kind of a standard procedure, and if you had a very important oath that you wanted to do, you would do this kind of, you would put your hand on the person's privates to show, I am really serious about this. However, it's such a kind of an unusual thing that I think that there should be a parallel. Also, the Torah only mentions an oath in this way twice in the Torah. Both are in the book of Bereshit. So one really kind of demands for us to look for some kind of parallel between the two stories. One possible connection is the burial place itself, the Ma'arat HaMachpelah. Now that was in chapter 23. Right before Avraham's making his servant take an oath, in chapter 24, because he was aging, much like Jacob is aging here, Avraham buys the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the cave, the lot where he buried his wife, to bury his wife and his family. That was in chapter 23. That same burial ground, the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, is what Jacob is making Joseph swear to bring him back to at this time. So perhaps there's a connection there. And it's a little bit tenuous, though, and I really think there should be a more religious, maybe even a mystical connection between these two oath-taking sessions, which share the idea of placing the one who's being adjured, the one who's being made to take an oath, placing one's hands on his yerech, on his privates. But I leave it up to you to look for other ideas. Anyway, Jacob continues, V'shachavti im avotai unsatani mimitzrayim ukvartani bikvuratam vayomar anochi e'eseg chidvarecha. Then I will lie with my fathers. You must carry me up from Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he, that is Joseph, said, I will do just as you said. But note that Joseph does not say, I swear I will do just as you said. Vayomer, hishava ali, vayishavalo, vayishtachu Yisrael al-Rosh HaMitah. And he, that is Jacob, said, swear to me. And he, that is Joseph, swore to him. And Israel bowed down at the head of the bed. Now, Ramban jumps all over this and says, God forbid that the righteous Joseph was trying to avoid taking an oath and that Jacob had to push him into doing so. Ramban asserts, in fact, that Jacob was satisfied with the words, Anochi esech chidvarecha, I'll do what you say. He trusted him. And that, in fact, the swear was not for Yosef's sake, but so that Yosef could essentially go to Paro and say, listen, I know you don't want Jacob, my father, being buried outside the land, but he made me swear to it. So then Paro would allow Joseph to go and do so, sort of a trick to force Paro's hand. However, the placement of the hands on the privates, it initiates a clear oath. We've seen that oath before by Eliezer back in chapter 24. And in fact, what Eliezer did right afterwards is he said, okay, I swear to do it. So why then does Joseph not at first simply say, I see you're making me swear, so I swear I will do as you instructed. Maybe he felt that only Paro had the right to really allow, since it was in Paro's hand, who would emigrate and where Jacob could get buried, so Joseph couldn't make the oath because he wasn't really in full command. So again, maybe like the Ramban is saying, Joseph is not in the position to make a swear, so Jacob is saying, listen, I need you to swear, that'll be good enough for Paro. That's really Ramban's position. Now, we never discussed, by the way, why it is so important that Jacob not be buried in Egypt, although we will see that Joseph feels the same way, since he makes sure that his bones will be carried out of Egypt back to Israel as well. The commentators offer various explanations dealing with the sanctity of Israel and the defiling nature of being buried outside of Israel. One of them that I find interesting is that Jacob and Joseph were worried that people would worship at their tombs and treat them as false gods, which seems very possible given Joseph's elevated position and the way that we know from the history books, from recorded history, that Egyptians essentially built pyramids or necropolises to feed and sustain the dead and did treat them like gods or like demigods. Finally, regarding Jacob's bowing, when it says he bowed at the end of the bed, the simple explanation is not bowing down to Joseph, although he could have, since Joseph was the leader, but I think the better explanation is that he's simply bowing in thanks to God that Joseph agreed to swear to bury him with his fathers. We will now continue the first Aliyah, and we will move to chapter 48, verse 1. Vayhi acharei hadavarim ha'ela, vayomer Yosef, hine avicha choleh, vayikach et shnei vanav imo et Menashe v'et Ephraim. It was after these events that he, an unknown person, said to Joseph, behold, your father is ill. So Joseph took his two sons with him, Menashe and Ephraim. It is clear that there is a physical separation between Joseph, who was the vizier of Egypt, living in no doubt the capital city, whether it's Memphis or Thebes, or we're never really told, and his family, who's living in the land of Goshen, and Jacob, who's living there as well. The land of Goshen is by the Nile Delta, in the very northern part of Egypt. It will also become clear that Jacob is demanding that Joseph come before his death and bring his sons. That is, this is really Jacob's initiative, as we will see. Vayagel Yaakov vayomer, hinei binecha Yosef ba'elecha vayitchazek Yisrael vayeshev al hamitah. And he, perhaps, the same unknown speaker, who no doubt was sent by Jacob to tell Joseph that his father was dying, told Jacob and said, behold, Joseph is coming to you, and Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. And we should notice that here, just on the previous verse, the name switches from Jacob to Joseph, sorry, from Jacob to Israel, right in the middle of a sentence. I could make a theory that the regular person, Jacob, the person who simply calls for his son, is called Jacob, but when he strengthens himself up to command the future of his nation, he is called Israel. And it fits here, but it doesn't really fit everywhere. You'd be really hard-pressed to find a theory which always satisfied why the Torah sometimes refers to him as Jacob and sometimes Israel, although I think, you know, 90% of the time it'll be right if you say that Jacob is when it's referring to him as a father, as a individual, and Yisrael is when he is involved in nationhood or nation processing or building. Vayomer Yaakov el Yosef, El Shaddai Nir'ah Alai Biluz Beretz Kanan, Vayivarechoti, Vayomer Elai Hinini Mafrecha, Vihir Biticha, Untaticha Likhal Amim, Venatati et Haaretz Hazot Lezarecha Acharecha Achuzat Olam. And Joseph said to Joseph, El Shaddai, El, of course, means God, and Shaddai is like the forceful, powerful, a name of God, appeared to me in Luz, that's the old name for Bethel, in the land of Canaan, and he blessed me, and he said, behold, I will make you fruitful, and I will increase your numbers, and I will make you into a gathering of nations, a Kahal Amim, which probably means, and really fits the idea coming up soon, that it is a nation made up of the unification of disparate tribes, and I will give this land as an eternal holding to your offspring who come after you. This is pretty much a direct quote from his return to Beit El in chapter 35. That's where Yaakov was coming back from Laban's house, from Padan Aram, and went first to Beit El. That's in verse 15. You have to be careful with chapter 35. There are two visits to Beit El, one following Shechem, which is from verse 1 to verse 8, and the second one is from verse 9 to and then on. But that one actually takes place chronologically earlier. That chapter is chronologically out of place. He went to Shechem after he went to Beit El. The first time. That's where Jacob first came in and went back to the place that he saw the dream of the ladder, and he promised he would come back, and that's where God says this blessing of how he will be a Kahal Amim. He will be a nation made up of the tribes and a numerous nation whose children will inherit the land of Israel, the promised land. V'atah shnei vanecha noladim lecha be'eretz Mitzrayim ad bo'i elecha Mitzrayima liheim Ephraim u'mnashe kiruvein v'shimon yeyuli. And now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, they are mine. Ephraim and Menashe will be to me like Ruvain and Shimon. Now remember the phrase, as I said, Kal Goyim or Kal Amim means a nation made up of tribes. And apparently Jacob wants Ephraim and Manasseh as part of the division of the future land of Israel, that they should be independent tribes. And this makes 100% sense because Joseph is the Bechor. Joseph is the firstborn. I'll explain that, why that is true in a second. And Moshe would later formalize the rules of the Bechor, but essentially the rules probably date back earlier that the Bechor, the firstborn, got a double portion of land. So now Reuben was the actual firstborn of Jacob, the firstborn to Leah, the first one that he had. But as it says in the book of Chronicles, in Divrei Hayamim Aleph, chapter 5, I believe, Uvnei Reuven Bechor Yisrael, ki hu ha-Bechor, uv'chalo Yitzuei Aviv, nitna b'chorato livnei Yosef ben Yisrael. It's amazing. Reuven lost the firstborn status due to bad behavior, which we'll see more later in a later aliyah. And Joseph, who was a firstborn also, but a firstborn of Rachel, got the nod. So Ephraim and Menashe are essentially number 1 and number 2. I guess Reuben gets pushed down to number 3. And what that means is that Joseph's share in the land, since he's the Bechor, is doubled. He gets two portions in place of Reuben. Reuben does not get two portions. This, by the way, ties into the part where Reuben tells his father Jacob that, you know, he'll take care of Binyamin if he goes down to Mitzrayim. If he doesn't take care of him, he could have his two kids killed. This is referring to that double portion, but this is not the place to go into detail on that connection. However, the children that you had after them, meaning that you, Yosef, had after I, Jacob, came down to Egypt, they will be known according to their brothers' names. they will be assigned in their inheritance. Meaning, when they start allying tribal property in Israel, it's not that all of your children get a separate piece of land, only your first two, because they will replace you, so you get a double portion, and any other children will have to go into either Manasseh or Ephraim's territories. Vani bivoimi padan meitalai rachel beretz kanaan baderech baod kivrat eretz lavo efrata vaekbira sham baderech efrat hi beit lachem. But I, while coming back from Padan Aram, meaning on the way back from my exile from Lavan, that I was staying with Laban, Rachel died on me on the road while still a short distance away from coming to Ephrat, and I buried her there on the road to Ephrat, also known as Beit Lachem. Now, this verse seems to be a real non sequitur. It seems to apply more to the previous meaning, what we read earlier, where Jacob made Joseph vow to bury him in the land of Canaan, in the Ma'arat HaMachpelah. In that context, had he mentioned the death of Rachel, then essentially Jacob would have been saying to his son, Joseph, listen, even though I didn't take the time or have the time to bury your mother in the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, and therefore it may not only not hold any special meaning to you, but there may be a certain bitterness for it to you, because Leah is there and not Rachel. Well, Leah, just according to our tradition, and Rachel certainly was not buried there. So he's saying, even though I didn't go through that process, I really want you to go ahead and take the time to bury me there. However, it's not located in the previous section. It's located right here where Jacob is assigning land ownership when they returned to the land of Canaan after what clearly Jacob feels is the beginning of the Egyptian exile. And as such, it points to a different purpose. That is, it must have a different meaning to Yosef in the context of I'm going to divvy up the land to you double, to your sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. I think it may be that Jacob is explaining to Joseph and to us that Rachel's burial on the way back from exile, that is, on the way back from Lavan, coming into the land of Israel, was done intentionally by Jacob as a spiritual paving of the way for all future returns from exile. Jacob is saying, in my opinion, perhaps, that Rachel is a road marker, an albatross, but not an albatross, that has a negative connotation, like following the dolphins in a ship where you know you're going the right way. That is, Rachel is there to cry for the children when they go out into exile and to sing for them when they come back into exile. The reason why she's on the road is because the road is the road from Padan Aram back to Israel was the first road back from exile, one that'll be taken again in the future back from Egypt, and then again from it was taken on the way back from Bavel, and it will be taken back again in the final Mashiach time. So while this may sound a little midrashic, a little homiletic, rather than really like pshat, I would argue that first of all, it fits into the context better, and second of all, Yirmiyahu, the prophet, seems to see it this way as well. He has the prophecy about how Rachel will cry for her children going to exile. So instead of Jacob mentioning it above, where it would put in an apology to Joseph, a negative thing, essentially Jacob is telling Joseph something about their future, that the reason why he buried her beloved mother on the road was so, his beloved mother on the road was so that she can act as a catalyst, an aid, a siren call to bring the Jews back from exile. And since they're about to enter exile, Jacob is sure, he's saying that's the purpose that he did it. Now, getting back to the issue of the actual children, he says, Vayar Yisrael et bnei Yosef, Vayomer mi'ela. And Israel saw the sons of Joseph and said, who are these, or to whom do these belong? Now, the simple sense is that Jacob cannot see well, as we will discover in the second Aliyah, and wants to make sure that he has the right kids, Joseph kids, before he blesses them. But I think that it could be that he's not just asking a question of who they are in a practical sense. He's asking, are these children, who do they belong to? Who is their allegiance to? Is it appropriate for me to give them a blessing only if they have the allegiance? Are they with us or not with us? And this seems possible based on Joseph's answers. I will explain. Vayomer Yosef Laviv, Benayim, they are my children. Asher Natan Li Elohim Bazeh, that God gave me with this. Vayomer Kachem Na Alai Barachem. So Jacob said, fine, so take them, bring them here, and I'll give them a blessing. And Joseph said to his father, these are my children who God has given to me in this, a very vague this. The word bazeh seems to hint at something significant, since zeh usually indicates that the person is pointing to something or referring to something. Rashi cites a beautiful medrash that Joseph pointed to his marriage and ketubah contracts. This beautiful medrash, which if understood on a literal level seems silly, because obviously there was no ketubah at the time, or not likely to be, is really pointing and really teaching us about an unstated tension that should have been bothering all of us for some time. Joseph is not only married an Egyptian girl, and his children are Egyptian, are trained in Egyptian ways, but apparently the girl is the daughter of a priest. Her father was Potipharah, the Kohen, the priest of On. Now back in Mikates, I offered some other possibilities on the identity and the position of this Potipharah, but no doubt, there's no doubt that it was a high-born marriage into Egyptian culture. And I think that Joseph is essentially responding to his father's question as follows. He's saying, who do these two really belong to? And then Joseph asserts that these two boys are worthy of Joseph's blessing because they are my children, that they are part of the Israelite tribe, and that the marriage, that medrash that talks about him holding up the ketubah, what he's saying is, listen, yes, I married into Egyptian culture, but I'm telling you that the marriage was done on my conditions as an Israelite and not on her conditions as the daughter of a priest. In fact, this may be the whole point of what Jacob is doing here, which is, he may be afraid that they will slip away into Egyptian society. And what he's doing them is he's officially escorting them and tying them into the tribe by allotting them to a piece of land. He's making sure that in the future exile of Egypt, their identity is always with the Israelites, and that they do not become assimilated into Egyptian culture, which is always, it's a perpetual danger when Jews are living not amongst themselves. In the next Aliyah, we will see what the blessing is, and we will see there's a little bit of drama surrounding it.